Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in the American West, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Ryan Driscoll-Tate, and our guest today is Nick Estes. He's an assistant professor of American Studies at the University of New Mexico and the co-founder of the indigenous resistance group, the Red Nation. Dr. Estes is a citizen of the Loa Brule Sioux tribe and the author of Our History is the Future, a book about the indigenous-led movement to stop the Dakota Access Pipeline and its historical context. The book is out now through the publisher Verso. Nick Estes, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Ryan.
So, Nick, why don't you take a few minutes before we get started to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and how you became a writer and an academic?
Sure. So I have an undergrad and a master's degree in history from the University of South Dakota, and I actually finished my PhD in American Studies from the University of New Mexico, where I am currently an assistant professor. And I actually began writing. I actually learned to write in grad school when I took a writing assignment to document and to report on border town violence, essentially police and state and vigilante violence against indigenous people who are seen as being off the reservation. And the reception for these pieces, which actually won an award at the Native American Journalists Association, really pushed me to consider writing for a popular audience. And so as a historian, you know, we are storytellers. And so I really wrote this book, Our History is the Future, for a wide audience or general audience, but also specifically for young people, because I see this book as kind of intervening in not just history as a discipline, but in the world and in politics, especially in indigenous movements.
So how did you come to write this book in particular? There's a real sense of urgency to the writing. And you talk about how you set aside your doctoral dissertation and wrote most of it in about a month.
Sure. I did the actual act of writing within a four-week period, but the research itself I had been doing for quite some time, because it's not just about the events that unfolded at Standing Rock. It's also about this longer kind of historical trajectory that I put Standing Rock within a larger, you know, historical context. And the way I wrote this book, you know, it was something that I was encouraged to do by others. I felt like I was abandoning my dissertation project, which actually became a condensed version of Chapter 7. Internationalism. And so my original dissertation project was looking at the question of indigenous internationalism within the specific context of the 20th and the 21st centuries. But the other chapters were actually papers that I had attempted to present at various conferences and had worked on, but then kind of, you know, became chapters or the bulk of this book. And in reality, the stories that I tell in this book, the longer kind of historical narrative that I tell, was actually something that I just grew up hearing as a child. My dad would tell me the history of the dams. I heard it from my grandparents. As I became a young adult, I heard a lot of these stories about the American Indian movement, specifically from the women that participated in Red Power themselves. And so the framing of, you know, even thinking about Red Power from the vantage point of American Indian women and specifically Lakota women actually comes from, you know, my own personal experience knowing a lot of these women like Mabel Ann Eagle Hunter and Madonna Thunderhawk and Marcy Gilbert, people who are in the book, but also Phyllis Young as well. But the other stuff with the 19th century and how it connects with the 20th century and the 21st century periods is that when we tell our history, oftentimes there isn't, you know, the kind of truncated periodization that we find typically in American history. Oh, this is the allotment, you know, the allotment era, the reservation era, the era of, you know, the Indian New Deal, you know, termination, Red Power, et cetera. You know, the way that a lot of these folks talk about history and the way that we talked about history growing up is that history very much constructs our present. And so in one sentence, you know, in one story, you would have a story that came, you know, what we call Uhunkanka, which is like from the before times, before there is like, you know, living memory, the old stories. And then the next story would be something that happened in the 20th century. Then the next story would be something that happened in the 19th century. And so the way that we understand history through oral tradition is very, I hate to use the word nonlinear because we do have a conception of time, right? But it very much bleeds into different eras. And I think there's a disservice that happens when we truncate things such as like the Wounded Knee Massacre as kind of marking the end of one era and the beginning of the other, because even Black Elk himself, who witnessed the Wounded Knee Massacre, and I talk about this in the book, didn't see that as like an end of a certain era. He just saw it as a continuation of what it means to be Lakota.
You know, you focus on seven historical moments in this book. Would you mind walking the readers briefly through what those are and how you came to focus on them?
So I chose seven historical moments specifically because seven is, you know, to represent the seven generations. And seven generations isn't just a projection of seven generations into the future. Actually, I consider Vine Deloria's conceptualization of the seven generations the most useful in thinking about what he called, you know, three generations back, three generations forward, and then the current generation is yourself. So, for example, if you've met your great grandparents, you know, in your lifetime, then you're considered a lucky person, right? But then also your grandparents and your parents, that's three generations. And if you're lucky enough, you can meet, you know, not just your children, but their children and their children's children. So your great grandchildren. So if a Lakota person, a Dakota person, you know, lived a good life, they could meet all of those generations. And it's not biological by any means, but it's a generational thing. And so these chapters are kind of split into thinking about each of these eras as a sort of generation. And the first is origins, which kind of juxtaposes our creation stories with the origins of capitalism and settler colonialism on our lands with the arrival of the fur trade. So I juxtapose the story of Teiskawi, the white buffalo calf woman, who essentially made us Lakota and Dakota people today and brought us into correct relations with the world, with the arrival of European invaders and then, you know, the United States fur trade, and how it really upset that world. And then the second chapter is called War, where I look at the concept of war as not something that has necessarily a beginning and an end, but it has a beginning, but something that hasn't really ended. And looking at the 19th century Indian wars on the Northern Plains as kind of a continuation of an Indian war and creating the modern tactics that we now know as counterinsurgency, but also looking at anti-colonial resistance movements, not just of the armed kind that we're familiar with, you know, such as like the victories of 100 in Hands, which was known as the Fetterman Massacre, or the victory of Greasy Grass, or which was known as the Battle of the Little Bighorn in 1776, 100 years, you know, when the United States was trying to celebrate its 100 years of so-called independence. But looking at like the more the resistance that happened during the Ghost Dance movement as well, and thinking of that as a modern anti-colonial movement that is just as important as these other sort of more armed struggles. And then the third chapter or the third era that I look at is it's called the Flood, which is looking at these New Deal era policies of damming the Missouri River, you know, beginning with the Fort Peck Dam in the 1930s to essentially provide regional employment opportunities for settlers, but also to provide irrigation and hydroelectricity, which then evolved into the 1944 Flood Control Act, which authorized the Army Corps of Engineers to build 5 earthen-rolled dams on the main stem of the Missouri River. In the end, it resulted in, you know, the annihilation of 75% of our wildlife on the Lakota and Dakota reservations within or that border the Missouri River, and the taking of 90% of our agricultural or of our commercial timber, and the removal of 1/3 of our reservation populations. And tribes such as the Fort Berthold Reservation, which are not part of the Ocheti Shakoi, but are made up of the Mandan, Arikara, and Hidatsa tribe, also, you know, faced much more profound loss, and, you know, anywhere upwards to like 90% destruction of their agricultural lands and a removal up to 80% of their tribal membership. So this era was very traumatic and very turbulent for a lot of our folks, not just the Lakota and Dakota people, but also other indigenous nations. And as a result, it coincided with, and it wasn't by accident, but it coincided with termination and relocation policies to terminate the federal status of tribal nations and then to relocate Native people off the land. So our land in this context wasn't really valued because it held some kind of like minerals or, you know, was desired as agricultural land, but our land was valued for the opposite reasons because it could be destroyed and wasted. And so it kind of works in tandem with federal termination policy, but also the massive public works projects that were going on at the time. And the fifth era that I talk about is Red Power in response to termination and relocation and the arrival of a new kind of militant protest movement, not just in the form of the American Indian movement, but in this broader kind of national and international context, and looking at how this really reshaped a lot of the politics in the region. And I look specifically at border towns such as Rapid City and how this was very much an off-reservation, but also an on-reservation movement. While we often think about, you know, the really spectacular forms of protest arising from Alcatraz, the occupation of Alcatraz in 1969, the Bureau of Indian Affairs takeover in 1972 with the Trail of Broken Treaties, or the Wounded Knee occupation in 1973, we often kind of forget the reasons why this movement kicked off. And that's what I try to really kind of push in this chapter, is to think about, you know, the survival schools that were created in the urban context as a challenge to the public education system, but also the women who played an important role in shaping those politics and creating organizations such as like Women of All Red Nations. And then the sixth era that I look at is the era that often gets left out when we talk about Red Power, and that's the movement to take the indigenous rights and treaty claims to the United Nations. And that actually, you know, centered in Standing Rock. There was the Standing Rock Sioux Tribal Council that had invited the American Indian movement and these Red Power activists to their nation when, you know, this was post Wounded Knee and a lot of places didn't want to accept them and take them in, but it was, you know, Standing Rock's kind of foresight as a tribal nation that saw them as a vehicle to take their treaty claims to the court. And the two areas that they wanted to focus on, as I point out in the book, were the destruction of the river because of the Pixlone dams, as well as the taking of the Black Hills, which happened in 1877 with the Black Hills Act. And so this was really a coalescence of the Red Power movement, but also it was a longer kind of historical movement that originated in the treaty councils. And it has its origins also in the Society of American Indians, which was founded by folks like Henry Standing Bear and Charles Eastman to actually take the treaty claim and the Black Hills claim to U.S. Congress. And then eventually they hoped to take it to the League of Nations following World War I, but that never happened for various reasons that I detail in the book. But looking at the trajectory, we can look at the touchstone document of the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, and we can look at the four decades that we fought for, beginning in 1974 until its passage in 2007, as historic, but also we can look at it within a longer kind of historical context as well. And that's what I try to do, and putting it specifically in the context of Lakota and Dakota movements. And then the last chapter, the seventh chapter, is liberation, which is kind of an unwritten, future-oriented chapter, where I'm really trying to draw from the lessons of the past and trying to put this the lessons that we can learn from our own struggle as the Ocheti Shakoi into the context of what a future premised on justice might look like. And as a historian, I often get asked the question, just the title of the book has the word future in it. So I'm often asked the question of what does a future look like? And I, to be honest, I don't know what that is, what it does look like. But as a historian, I think my philosophy on it is that I look, I travel backwards, walking backwards into the future, looking at the past to help kind of guide me. And so that's my response to that. Those questions is that this is really kind of a study and a meditation on our past to understand the resurgent indigenous histories that happened at Standing Rock, but they're not just kind of truncated. It's not just a moment in time, but it's a continuation.
Yeah, that's excellent. At one point you're talking about the counterinsurgency tactics to repress resistance as part of a global war. Could you talk more about the global mechanism in place that you saw at Standing Rock and in your work?
Sure. I spent some time looking through the emails that were released by, the Muck Rock website, and looking at some of the documents that were released by The Intercept. And looking at the ways in which private security personnel, as well as law enforcement personnel who were operating in the context of the Standing Rock protests, were framing their role and the examples that they were drawing on. And one kind of smoking gun email for me was an email that was sent by a private security a private contractor. He was just a helicopter contractor that would essentially fly his helicopter. He had a yellow helicopter. We called it Tweety Bird in the camps. And we've seen it outside the context of the camps, but essentially his company was like a first response oil spill company that was hired by a lot of these fracking rigs and stuff. In case there was an oil spill, he would go out and throw, I think it was like wood chips on it or something, but he was being contracted by Tiger Swan, this kind of murky mercenary security company that was hired by Dakota Access Pipeline to police these protests. But then we found out later was actually providing intelligence from this aerial surveillance helicopter company. And this helicopter company, this pilot, was sending emails, to these police officers, and he's like, one email he said, you should check out this biochemical weapon called skunk spray that the Israeli Defense Forces had developed to use against Palestinian civilians protesting, Israeli occupation of their homelands. And then, you know, further on in the email, he lists all of these things of where skunk spray should be deployed along the U.S.-Mexico border, at Ferguson and Baltimore to prevent, like, quote-unquote, looters. And so essentially what he was doing is he was placing the Standing Rock within the context of a lot of these larger uprisings. And even the Field of Force manual that was circulated by FEMA and Homeland Security amongst the law enforcement who are working this, the protests, actually references specifically Black-led uprisings in Ferguson and Baltimore. And even Jack Dalrymple, the governor of North Dakota, when he declared a state of emergency, invoked the powers of the Emergency Management Assistance Compact, which had last been used by the state of Baltimore to crush a Black-led uprising after the police killing of Freddie Gray. And so in the context of North Dakota, EMAC, as the acronym is known, was actually used to suppress, you know, a quote-unquote, like, domestic uprising. And so the Emergency Management Assistance Compact was actually created to help states in times of natural disaster. But it's been more and more used as a emergency effort against these uprisings, whether they're Black-led uprisings or in the context of Standing Rock and Indigenous-led uprisings. So in many ways, it's not me just kind of like pulling this stuff out of a hat and saying, you know, these movements are all intersectional, and, you know, we have to be allied with Black Lives Matter, we have to be allied with Palestinian rights and all those things. I can say that, but the actual connection that the security state is making itself is actually saying these movements are connected to Black Lives Matter and Palestinian justice.
Yeah, and you make the point too, when you're talking about the no-doppel camps, you're using the words of Ruth Wilson Gilmore here. You call them an abolition geography. Could you talk more about what you mean by an abolition geography?
Right. Ruthie is essentially talking about, or she's building on W.E.B. Du Bois's notion of an abolition democracy, which kind of came out of Reconstruction, or radical Reconstruction, as he, you know, as he writes in Black Reconstruction. And what he's talking about is this kind of like this, you know, kind of the suspension of the normative anti-Blackness following, you know, the Civil War, and this attempt to create a more democratic society, right? And so Ruthie Gilmore is really drawing from that kind of Black radical tradition and arguing that, you know, freedom, you know, isn't just a practice, but it's an actual place, and it manifests in certain, you know, times. And she, you know, she references anything from the Palestinian Intifada to efforts to reclaim kind of like Black and Latino neighborhoods in moments of uprising. And so, for example, we can see, you know, we can talk about the Ferguson uprising and the way it brought together rival gangs. And you know, despite all the federal and private foundation money that goes into preventing gang violence and curbing gang violence, it's actually a Black-led uprising against police violence that actually unites rival gangs. And so in these moments of crisis, new kind of possibilities emerge. And I would say that the no-doppel camps were part of that. You know, freedom is a place. People create societies when given the opportunity according to their own needs, and they don't naturally tend towards creating kind of coercive institutions of the state. And so I make the point that the kind of, we can look at what was not in the no-doppel camps, and what was not there was a military. You know, the military surrounded the camps for sure. And what was not there were an armed body of the state, right? There were no weapons allowed. And what were not there were also the keeping out of drugs and alcohol. But, you know, what I argue is that Indigenous kind of liberation isn't just the absence of settler colonialism or the absence of these institutions. It's actually the amplified presence of Indigenous social and political and cultural institutions. So we had In the positive sense, we had the reunification of the Ocheti Shakoni. They rebuilt the Camp Horn, kind of modeled after what we know in history as the nation of the seven council fires, the Lakota, Nakota, and Dakota speaking people. So representatives were chosen to represent each of those seven original council fires. We also had the creation of, you know, in true indigenous hospitality, the number one question is, how are you going to get fed, right? So yeah, the creation of kitchens, right? That provided, you know, free food to everybody who could come. We had a donation tent that, you know, people, campers who didn't have tents, who didn't have jackets, who didn't have sleeping bags, et cetera, were provided for. You know, what really makes a movement is like what I saw at Standing Rock is people would just show up, you know, families who had nothing all of a sudden had a place, you know, in this new world that was under creation. And you also had free health clinics that were set up by folks like Linda Black Elk and Sarah Jumping Eagle, and, you know, promoting, you know, holistic health care, not just kind of like preventative care, although there was a lot of that and triage, of course, because people were getting brutalized by police. But looking at, you know, holistic health care and thinking about health care in a different way, and that was free and provided to everybody. The other one was education. You had the Defenders of the Water School built by Elena, or founded and, you know, kind of promoted by Elena Eagleshield, which, you know, the question is like, who's going to take care of all these kids? This is the, you know, the 10th largest city in North Dakota. You know, there's children here. How are they going to be taken care of? And so that was another question. And so free education, free healthcare, free food, you know, access, not just free food, but access to quality food. You know, most Indian reservations and poor communities in the United States and the rest of the world don't have access to these things. And it demonstrates that in the absence of, you know, the coercive elements of the state, that people, indigenous people first, but then also people in general, provide the things or the needs of society for everybody. And so I think that was that really crystallizes what Ruthie Gilmore was calling abolition geography.
Just when you were talking, you got at something else I noticed in the book, which is the importance of women in these resistance movements. Could you talk more about the importance of women and gender, both at Standing Rock and in the longer tradition of indigenous resistance movements?
Right. You know, of all indigenous people, Lakota people specifically, and even to some degree, Dakota people as well, but Lakota people specifically are often seen as hyper-masculine societies. If you just Google Lakota people or Lakota leaders and you look at the images that come up, they're more likely going to be tintype black and white photographs of indigenous men of the 19th century. And while they should be recognized as leaders, absolutely. In the first encounters we had with Europeans were primarily European men, right? A lot of these fur traders, a lot of these so-called explorers and soldiers and settlers came out just as groups of men. And, you know, I trace this back to the arrival of, you know, the fur trade, because the fur trade in my mind, or to my mind and to many of us, were the first man camps. They were called fur trade forts. You're combining economy and markets with militarization, right? And what happened at these fur trade forts? And I give the example of, you know, the place where I was born and raised in Chamberlain, South Dakota, which was formerly Fort Kiowa, which played a huge kind of role in the, you know, the blockbuster film, The Revenant, which was fictionalized to some degree, but the depiction of violence, I would argue, was fairly accurate. Because there was a lot of rape, there was a lot of violence against indigenous women and children. And when, you know, Hugh Glass, the main protagonist, who is played by Leonardo DiCaprio, when he arrives at Fort Kiowa, outside he sees indigenous women and children kind of begging and also being traded amongst the fur trade, the fur traders themselves, who are these white men who are living in a transient, you know, all men camp, right? In an extractive industry, which was the fur trade. And so these fur trade forts really were the first man camps, and they later became border towns. But the penetration of capital into our homelands and the penetration of capital into many other, you know, indigenous contexts coincides with extreme amounts of gendered violence against indigenous women specifically. And it was not just violence for violence sake, but it actually performs a political function, because I would argue that it undermines indigenous women's political authority within our own nations, because trade diplomacy is only seen as the realm of men, right? And so when you don't recognize women's leadership, then, you know, you're not going to make treaties with them. You're not going to trade with them, right? And so the subordination of indigenous women's political authority is an important part of the colonization process. And it's affected the way that we write history, unfortunately, because a lot of those indigenous women are simply erased. And not just indigenous women, you know, folks who are non-gender conforming don't fall into that binary. And that's something that we've lost, unfortunately, to a large degree, is those histories. But we do see the continuation of indigenous women's societies into the 20th and 21st centuries that still hold that oral history. And there are projects that are coming out about it. But, you know, I think one of the most compelling figures in my mind that often is so misunderstood is Zinkala Shah, or, you know, who was born Gertrude Bonin. But she's such a compelling figure in my mind because she embodies kind of the tenacity of a lot of Dakota and Lakota women in our own political and intellectual traditions. But yet her role is often minimized, even though she was advocating things in the early 20th century that most tribes today, you know, won't advocate for because they're considered too radical. But I think she kind of really, in my mind, epitomizes that kind of tradition amongst Lakota and Dakota women specifically.
Yeah, and the book is filled with those stories of violence, of genocide and settler colonialism. But you end with a sense of possibility for collective liberation. Liberation is the title of your last chapter. I think the end is really a call to action. You say, for the earth to live, capitalism must die. Could you tell us more about that sense of possibility?
I'm of the mind that capitalism, because it is a social system and has enveloped the globe, is a primary driver of climate change. And I'm also of the mind that indigenous knowledge alone is not going to save the planet. I think there are remnants within our knowledge systems, our cultural practices, and our outlook, you know, our worldview, that are kind of the building blocks for a new world. But I think it's simplistic and, you know, just frankly wrong to say that indigenous peoples have the answer to global climate change and to stave off, you know, what is the sixth mass extinction on planet Earth. So what that means, and why I'm bringing that up, is because the tackling of something like, you know, climate change, we can deal with the symptoms, right? And there are already proposals to transition us out of the kind of fossil fuel economy, but it's being led by the same, you know, captains of industry who got us into this mess in the first place. And to my mind, that is the primary contradiction. Climate change is not just an indigenous problem. It's everybody's problem. And, you know, we have to confront that in a very honest way. And I think the most successful movements within the last 50 years have been allied, specifically in the context of the United States, I should say, have been allied indigenous and non-indigenous movements. Somebody like Zoltan Grossman, you know, has a book called Unlikely Alliances, where he traces these kind of more rural alliances between indigenous organizers and white organizers who are considered quote unquote like traditional enemies, you know, but they've beat back these multinational corporations. And the next step, I think, is I think Standing Rock shows what's possible, right? When we foreground decolonization, which includes indigenous and non-indigenous people, and when we foreground, anti-capitalism, and that's a very broad subject, right? But I think in the long run, it includes everybody, and everybody has a role to play. And I think what we're seeing now with proposals, by folks such as Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez with the Green New Deal, is that there is something that we have to fight for. Who's going to fund the Green New Deal? You know, where are we going to get the resources to do this? They exist, and they're over. You know, we exist in a society of overabundance, and I think the Green New Deal points to that, to say that this wealth may be ill-gotten and needs to be redistributed, and these resources need to be redistributed to repair the planet. And there's a conversation and a debate happening about what that looks like. But I will say, and I do want to emphasize this, is that Ocasio-Cortez is herself a water protector. She began her campaign, her successful campaign for Congress when she was at Standing Rock. She arrived after Trump's election, like many people who were disillusioned, right, with what had just happened. And so this history really continues beyond the camps.
I read elsewhere too that your study of the Pick Sloan Plan, which is part of your chapter on flooding, broached concerns for you about some of the rhetoric around the Green New Deal right now and the massive federal works projects. Could you elaborate on that and what that meant for indigenous communities in the past?
Right. I think to look at this in a longer context, and I don't specifically say this in the book, but if we look at, I kind of separate it out as like four invasions of our specific territory. So Chetty Shakoni, the first was the fur trade, which, essentially the expansion into that, into the Missouri River Basin, happened in 1837 when there was a national economic kind of collapse for the United States. The third was the annihilation of the buffalo and the Continental Railroad, which happened, during Reconstruction. And then, you had the crash of 1873, which led to a greater push westward. And then you have the third invasion, which I would call the New Deal era, right? With the collapse, the Great Depression, and the push to build these large public work projects to essentially pull the settler economy out of the gutter. And now we're in the fourth invasion, which is the North American oil boom, where because of, federal policies that incentivize domestic oil production, specifically starting around 2007 and 2008 with the subprime mortgage crisis, you have the increase, from 2008 to 2016, domestic oil production in the United States increased by 88%. And we are now the number one producer and exporter of oil in the world. We have surpassed, because of, recent discoveries of oil, like in the Permian Basin, we have now surpassed Saudi Arabia and Russia. And so when we're looking at, when we've looked at how the United States and how these settler economies get themselves out of the gutter, they often turn to indigenous lands. And so essentially what's happened is the U.S. has drilled its way out of the Great Recession. And when we lack alternatives, we get folks like, Trump, and we get right-wing authoritarians, whether it's in Bolsonaro in Brazil, whether it's Modi in India. This is a global phenomenon, right? These are responses to these kind of geopolitical alignments, realignments that are happening. And the Green New Deal, while, we support it, and I support it personally in principle, it kind of invokes that language of like, we're going to do another mass scale, public works project to essentially, save the planet. But how is that going to happen? I get concerned because, is it going to be the extraction of biofuels, is this going to be exported to, you know, the violence of this going to be exported to other parts of the world where, you know, rare earth mining is destroying, you know, people's communities and sacred sites? These are things that I'm deeply concerned of. I don't think that's the intention behind it, but it could be the result of it.
Yeah, yeah. And I'd be remiss not to point out, too, for future readers of this book, that it's so well written. And Philip DeLoria writes that you have, quote, the literary skill of the poet, unquote. And I wanted to ask you, this book is part history, manifesto, intergenerational story. What was the hardest part for you to write?
The hardest part to write was the personal part of it, the part that I center myself. And I went back and forth over it because for me, like even reading, I remember reading my grandfather's words for the first time when I was an adult. I had no idea that he was a writer, that any of my grandparents were writers or historians. And I felt like in some ways when, you know, sharing that history was very personal to me. But then also the idea that like my, you know, that my personal story is like somehow exceptional or unique, and I will say flat out that it's not at all. And what convinced me to share that kind of personal aspect of, you know, my family history is that I hope that it would encourage others to see, you know, like that this isn't just my history, but this is many people's history. My family story isn't unique. We were one of many families who was displaced by the dams. We're one of many families who have a long tradition of historians and intellectuals. You know, I'm one of thousands and thousands of Lakota people who have these traditions. And so in that sense, it gives you just a slice and a sliver. And if somebody wants to, you know, live vicariously through are, you know, through my story, then that's fine. I just want to say first and foremost, it's not exceptional. And that's really what convinced me. I had a back and forth with one of my editors. And she really convinced me that this is something that, you know, needs to happen. And actually, I feel like in some ways it was a breakthrough because it's not really about the self in that sense. It's about kind of my family history as a collective, but also my nation, Lower Brule Sioux tribe, as well as the larger nation, the Ocheti Shakoi. It's our history in that sense. It's not just mine to say that I have the right to share it or not. It's actually, it belongs to a lot of people.
Is that what you mean when at one point you call this a history of relationships? You write that rather than a study of objects, individuals, and ideas, this is a history of relationships. Is that what you mean?
Absolutely. It's a temporal relationship with time. I mean, I've heard Madonna Thunderhawk said it best. You know, somebody had asked her at one of her film showings about her, you know, her and her daughter called Warrior Women. They asked her, they said, why do you do this work? It's brought, you know, so much pain and anguish to your own, you know, personal life, you know, and you shared this story and it's very vulnerable. You know, it's a very touching story. And she said, my goal is to be a good ancestor to future generations. And to my mind, that's what I was trying to accomplish in this book. It's not just about the relationship with the present, but it's to be a good, you know, ancestor to the future. And an elder once told me, she said, you know, she told me flatly, she said, you don't even own your own life, my dear. You're only here to ensure the coming generations. And you know, it's not this fatalistic kind of like, you know, view. It's actually, I think it's a very poetic view. I think it's a very, it's humbling because in some senses you don't feel alone. You have the weight of history that's pushing, you know, you forward and pushing you onwards. But also the goal is to, you know, pass that down to younger folks as well. And so I think that relationship I am really trying to establish with a certain reader, which is young folks, people like myself who needed something like this growing up.
Right, right. You know, Nick, we've taken up quite a bit of your time already, so I just have a couple of questions for you. First of all, what are you working on next? What else can we look forward to from you?
Yeah, my next project is looking at, it's going to be taking up the dissertation that I didn't abandon, but put on kind of the back burner. But I'm looking at Indigenous internationalism, and not just in the progressive sense of like going to the United Nations and establishing our rights, but actually how indigeneity, you know, really thinking like what Jody Bird has done with Transitive Empire, how indigeneity really gets inscripted into the imperial project in the 20th century. And so, for example, looking at like the way that these New Deal reformers that were brought into the Indian, the Bureau of Indian Affairs under John Collier, were actually later hired by the Department of Navy to work on the transition of from military to civilian rule in newly acquired territorial possessions in the Pacific, right? And how, you know, the War Relocation Authority camps, many of the Indian Bureau anthropologists were hired to essentially oversee or to study civilian administration in a prisoner of war camp. Some of them were actually housed on reservations, such as the Colorado Indian Reservation, and how Indian reformers themselves, indigenous people themselves, became part of that project. But then also like how, you know, later on, indigenous internationalism was something that was contested. Was it part of the Third World? Was it part of the Global South? Was it separate from that? You know, these are things that I'm really interested in. And I think, you know, one of the areas that I've always found really productive in having a conversation around, you know, especially that there's more emerging scholarship on it, is the question of Nicaragua in the 1980s and how it really, and I didn't get a chance to touch on it in my book, but how it really split parts of the Red Power movement over the question of whether they should back the Mosquito Indians who were being, you know, supplied with weapons by the CIA and the Contras to overthrow the Sandinistas, or whether they should back the Sandinista rebellion. And you know, some people boil it down to the question of Marxism, but I think there's something deeper there. And but to my mind, I think the productive question is that indigenous people in the 20th century specifically saw themselves as global people and thought beyond the bounds of the nation state. So that's the next project that I'm working on.
Wow, that's excellent that you continue with the internationalism scholarship, because that was a very good chapter in the book. And so it'd be great to see where that goes in the future. Before we go, could you tell us a little bit about the Red Nation and some of your work actually in New Mexico?
Sure. The Red Nation is an indigenous-led organization that formed in 2014. And we formed to address border town violence, which, you know, is kind of a vernacular amongst indigenous people. Essentially, what a border town is the white-dominated settlements that ring Indian reservations where, you know, patterns of violence, whether it's from the police or everyday settlers, kind of defines everyday life off the reservation. And that could be pretty much anywhere in the United States. But essentially, we started as like an urban kind of based organization in Albuquerque, looking at working with folks who are experiencing houselessness. And we've expanded to look at, you know, areas of LGBTQ rights within indigenous communities. We're now working on challenging fracking in the greater Chaco landscape, while there has been like a moratorium placed on fracking in Chaco Canyon. Navajo or Diné communities are still affected by the kind of checkerboarded area. And so we've been working with a lot of those folks and on moving towards a moratorium on fracking within the state. And then also that kind of like springboards us into the next project, that the next major project that we're working on, which is something we call the Red Deal, which is not really against the Green New Deal, but expanding it for like an indigenous context. And so we're focusing on three areas. The first is what we call End the Occupation. It's like looking at divestment from carceral institutions, the military, immigration, et cetera, and reinvesting into two other areas, which we call healing our bodies and healing the land. And healing our bodies includes anything from sustainable and appropriate housing, because housing crisis in the Indian country on and off the reservation is a really big issue. Mental health, youth suicide, murder and missing indigenous women, and then land restoration is like, how do we create sustainable jobs that are actually bolstering what's already being done on the land with caretakers of the land, caretakers of water, of air, of animals, and people who are living in the kind of urban context. So it's kind of like a holistic plan that we're working on and thinking about grassroots policy reform. But it really kind of gets at the heart of who we are as the Red Nation. We're a youth-led organization. I'm not an elected leader. I'm just a rank-and-file member. But we have about 50 committed members and about 100 to 200, I'm not quite sure, people that are kind of at large that are doing work. And we're not a nonprofit. We're entirely self-funded. We work on anything from migrant rights and undocumented indigenous communities to murdered and missing indigenous women, to the extractive economies, to just holding, political education workshops within the context of Albuquerque, Gallup, Santa Fe, Navajo Nation, or any of the surrounding pueblos. So yeah, the Red Nation is just kind of a political vehicle of the intellectual project that I'm a part of in the academy.
And is it theRedNation.org? Is there a website where you can send people to?
Yeah, it's theRedNation.org. And you can find information on the Red Deal. We also have a podcast called Red Revolution Radio. I'm the one who writes the newsletter, and I've been kind of derelict in my duties, but there should be another newsletter coming out soon with a lot of the events that we have going on in the summer. So if folks want to check it out, you can go there.
Excellent. Nick, I just want to thank you so much for being on the show today. Our History of the Future is out now. And Nick, we really hope to have you back again soon.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Ryan.
Yeah, take care.